Hello and welcome to Fourth Estate, the media show coming to you from Tuasea on Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation and right across Australia on the Community Radio Network. My name's Mariam Chihab. Tonight, we're talking leaks and exposés. First, we had the Unaoil scandal, with Fairfax and Huffington Post revealing how the company has corrupted the global oil industry by handing out bribes. And just a few days ago, we had the release of the Panama Papers, the world's biggest data leak, with news organisations around the world revealing how the rich and famous have used tax havens to hide their wealth. These scandals would not have been exposed without the collaboration between journalists. So tonight we're asking, how do journalists share their story with their competitors? Joining me in the studio is Jonathan Perlman from the UK's Daily Telegraph. Welcome, Jonathan.
Thanks.
Also in the studio is Wendy Bacon, contributing editor at New Matilda. Hi, Wendy.
Hi. Nice to be here.
Thank you. And joining us on the line from Melbourne is Denham Sadler, editor of Startup Smart, a publication for the startup community. Hi, Denham.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Remember, if you'd like to get in touch with us through Twitter, you can find us at Fourth Estate AU, all letters, no numbers. A massive leak that came from a law firm based in Panama called Mossack Fonseca has revealed that 11 million documents has revealed more than 11 million documents and exposed the secret financial dealings of some of the world's wealthiest and most powerful. A year-long investigation was led by the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, who collaborated with nearly 400 journalists from the world's top media organisations, including the Four Corners team here in Australia. Wendy, what does it mean to finally be able to prove what people have known all along about international corruption?
Well, I don't know whether it's proved for the first time, first of all. I mean, this is really, although I don't want to take away from the significance of this story, but actually when you look at what the International Consortium of Journalists has been doing, they've actually had a series of these major exposés on global tax. And even a couple of years ago, they did one on Luxembourg. So, you know, I think it's really building this whole understanding of how this industry works. And certainly this is at a new level. But really, I think it's part of a bigger story and much more attention on multinational tax avoidance also than there has been maybe a decade ago. So it's a building process, and I think it's also a community education process through journalism.
Jonathan, the cynicism around how much change this leak can actually bring about, those implicated are already claiming they've behaved in line with law. What do you think of this criticism?
Well, I think just exposing it in itself will have an impact. Leaders around the world, and particularly in countries like China and Russia, where a lot of these leaks have come from, you know, they might think twice about where they're putting their money in the future. They'll be worried about the risk of future exposés like this. So I think it's going to have that effect. And I think it will also add to the impetus for change in this area. The G20 has been looking at international tax avoidance and evasion, and it's only going to add to that. So I think it's very significant. I hope we get more leaks like this, and I think it will definitely add to a sort of growing international push for change.
Denham, what do you think about this criticism?
Yeah, I think that's always kind of the cynical reaction to this sort of thing. It's like, oh, we already knew it was happening. But I think, yeah, it's obviously huge to have this amount of documents kind of proving it all. And yeah, I think like Jonathan says, one of the big outcomes is always once there's a big leak, it kind of might encourage other people to come forward that might have information, and obviously we're likely to see more stories like this. So yeah, it's pretty huge for starting the whole discussion surrounding it, definitely.
And I think what is new, and perhaps I didn't emphasise enough, is that, like, when I was at Fairfax, you know, decades ago, we were doing stories on multinational tax avoidance, particularly involving Kerry Packer at that time, who was a major Australian businessman. But we had the companies, we had information, but we didn't have the actual documents. And what's been happening in the last decade is these massive leaks of actual information. And that applies to both these two big stories that have just happened. And that really takes it to a whole to a really different level. And so I think it is really significant.
The documents are probably becoming easier to leak as well. I mean, you don't actually need a brown paper bag anymore. You can have an anonymous USB stick.
Yes, that's right. I mean, back in that story, I was carrying documents around in a case, you know, on a plane. Now it is all happening much more electronically. Although in the case of the Unior one, Richard Baker actually did go to Paris, so it's not completely digital.
You're speaking, Jonathan, of how it's easier for documents to be leaked. So what impact do you think this will have on the big law firms and the big corporations who might engage in this shady activity?
Well, I'm sure there'll be redoubling efforts to try to prevent it. But hopefully it will encourage further leaks. I mean, I think this law firm is the fourth biggest in the world in terms of its involvement in setting up offshore companies. I mean, that fact alone is quite incredible. I mean, that means there are three firms that are bigger than it, and this firm's been involved in setting up hundreds of thousands of them. So, you know, there's obviously a lot more we'd like to know about what's going on in this area, and it's very difficult. Authorities are limited. You know, that's why these small countries are involved, almost sort of exploiting their own nationhood. So leaks are probably one of the best ways we're going to get there, and hopefully there'll be more of them.
In another huge expose this week, Fairfax Media and Huffington Post revealed how a Monaco company called Unaoil used portions of the Middle East oil industry from 2002 to 2012 to benefit Western companies. After a six-month investigation, the media organisations revealed that billions of dollars of government contracts were awarded through bribes from firms including Rolls-Royce, Halliburton, Leyden Holdings, Samsung and Hyundai. Jonathan, when was the last time an Australian outlet broke global news this huge?
It's a tough question. It was a big story. And I think some of the big stories which have had global reach by Australian journalists have often involved Australian correspondents based abroad. There was, I think it was Carolyn Overington broke the story about the oil for food scandal in Iraq. There was also even stories across Southeast Asia. Australians broke, you know, incredibly important stories in East Timor and Indonesia. Also, you know, stories like the Papua New Guinea in Bougainville, the involvement of the Sandline mercenaries. So I think there have been stories broken by the Australian media, but a lot of the time it's involved Australian media who are already overseas.
Wendy, how are sources protected in investigations like this, especially in regards to their identity?
Well, I think that's quite a big question, and the sort of technologies behind it and all of that sort of thing. But if you go onto the Fairfax website and you go actually to this investigation, which is incredibly well presented and set out in much smaller stories, so it's not one great big read, and then you can go there. How do you contact Nick McKenzie, who's one of the key journalists involved in this major expose? They got this story because they are very well known in Australia, and they have been working on latents and corruption, and so that's, I think, how they were identified. Now, on the website sets out how you contact them, what you need to know about how to protect yourself, and of course you can even go to higher levels in terms of protection. But I think, you know, while that's all said, what is really interesting in this case, and you can also see the video online of this, is that Richard Baker actually got a letter, an actual sort of mailed letter with telling him to put an ad. It was almost like a spy movie, an ad in a French newspaper, real estate section, and then someone would see that and then contact would be made. And then he actually flew to Paris and was outside the Louvre, and then the person didn't turn up, which was a complete freak out for him. He expresses that, like, to spend that amount of resources, you know, be a massive deal. And then eventually through text messaging and everything, he does get to sit down with the person. Then painstakingly they make contact with other sources, and eventually the information obviously comes through in an anonymous form. And so I suppose in saying that, obviously for all investigative journalists now, that if they're serious, they do need to understand all this protection of sources at an electronic level. But a lot of the old methods, I think, still exist as well. And, of course, it's always just ultimately important to protect the source. And so that's the responsibility of the journalist.
Jonathan, how important then is it to keep a scoop like that under wraps and present it in long form?
Well, I thought this was terrifically presented. And I think it showed the significance of doing that, of trying to keep a story for yourself and try to treat it properly. This was a big, complicated story with lots of different elements, and they took the time to sort of sit on it and report it properly. I thought it was really well done. Obviously, you can't do that in all circumstances. I mean, this was one where they knew that they had the story to themselves and weren't going to, no one was going else was going to beat them to it.
So in the age of news syndication, do you think The Age is receiving the credit it deserves for this story?
I think people are very aware that they've broken this story. I don't think it got a great deal of follow-up from the other Australian media outlets. That often happens due to sort of some extent petty sort of rivalries.
In fact, I saw that in the Australian, I think Mark Day commented that it was boring, which I think, and then Stephen Mayne, another journalist, has had a go at him about that. But actually what I think it was probably Crikey or said anyway, apparently in terms of hits, it has gone very well for Fairfax. So I think you're right that they have, in a way, got the credit for it. But the follow-up is perhaps what can let the story die, do you think?
Yeah, I mean,
hopefully not, but it could let it die.
I think the police investigations abroad helped it. It gave something for the other media to latch onto and media around the world to latch onto, rather than just relying on documents that Fairfax was reporting. So I think that's helped kick it along a little bit.
You're listening to Fourth Estate. You're with me, Mariam Chihab, and I'm speaking to Wendy Bacon, Jonathan Perlman and Denham Sadler. The Panama Papers is the biggest collaboration so far from the ICIJ, involving nearly 400 journalists in more than 80 countries and more than 100 media organisations. Journalists are used to hiding information from other journalists in order to be the first to break a story, sometimes at the expense of the quality of reporting. Yet this giant collaboration was pulled off in secret, with the news organisations and journalists involved willing to share and collaborate. Wendy, first of all, can you tell us more about the ICIJ, how it works and when it was formed?
It was formed in the late 90s. It initially involved far less than that number of journalists, but certainly journalists in Australia and all around the world got together because I think there was a recognition, one, that there needed to be a big non-profit initiative to get this sort of collaborative work going. And secondly, I think because there was a recognition that so many stories now are global and local. One of their early investigations involved the privatisation of water around the world, which is a story that continues to develop and have ramifications. Another one was illegal tobacco smuggling, and a journalist in Australia who now works at Monash, Bill Birnbaum, played a very key role in that. That was much more probably traditional investigative journalism, but everybody at the ground doing their part of the investigation, then it was filtered up and then written and in Washington probably and published. So they've got quite a long a tradition. Currently, the journalist who's actually managing the ICIJ is Gerard Ryle, who's well known in Australia because he was a very leading investigative journalist in Australia. He's actually Irish. And I think he actually had done a big story called Firepower, involving a lot of international tax avoidance and that sort of thing when he took up the job. And I think he had a real interest in this sort of journalism. And I guess how they keep it, I think it really is an interesting thing how you can manage. First of all, it's a big management task. But secondly, I think to even get into that group, you need to have a record, a really strong ethical record in investigative journalism. Whether you're in Ecuador, whether you're in Guatemala or Australia, you come with a record. And I think, I mean, of course, there could always be a rogue person within that, but very unlikely, because I think from my knowledge of journalists, when they're at that level, they're very aware of the ethics and an absolute need to keep it confidential. But it's still pretty amazing that it was as confidential as it was, I think, and a great credit, I think, to them, because it was important to bring it out all around the world in that way. That gives it a bigger chance of having impact.
Denham, how significant is this collaboration to you, given that news outlets are competing neck and neck with each other most of the time?
Yeah, well, I think it's pretty amazing. I think it was 370 journalists or something all kind of working together pretty much, and like nobody broke the publication date. And yeah, I think it's a pretty amazing testament and probably a recognition to these people kind of realizing that it was more than just journalism and kind of petty media infighting. It was kind of such a huge story. And I think it also comes down to there wasn't necessarily that much competition within the countries. Like I think it was three publications within Australia that was involved with it. So it's not necessarily as big a problem when you're not fighting against others in the country. But it's just huge to have that many journalists involved in a project and kind of no leaks from within that. And yeah, it's a pretty amazing story. The kind of story behind the story is pretty incredible too.
And so do you think this is a watershed moment for mass collaboration in journalism?
I don't know about a watershed moment, but I think it kind of just proving that it can be done. I definitely haven't heard of anything on this quite bigger scale. So, I think kind of the fact that it can be done, and hopefully we'll see a lot more of it, because you don't often see this sort of investigative journalism nowadays. So kind of proving that it can be done in a collaborative sort of way is a pretty huge moment.
What do you think, Jonathan? A watershed moment or not?
Yeah, I think for organisations like the ICIJ, I think they'll be pretty pleased to see that it can be done. I think it's an incredible sort of logistical feat to have that many outlets and that many journalists working on a story without it breaking. Embargoed press releases and documents get put out all the time, and the embargoes get broken, sometimes accidentally. Here's a case where people have been sitting on this for a year investigating it. The fact that it can be done together is terrific, and I think it will help build a bit of trust, because the main reason that stops this happening is everybody thinks that everybody else is going to report it before they do. Well, here everybody's trusted each other, and hopefully it'll happen again.
I think another thing about the ICIJ is that it is a non-profit idea, and all the time, they're putting out information about investigative journalism, information about the importance of public interest journalism. It's actually funded mainly by big foundations in the US. Of course, we don't have them to that extent here, but on the other hand, the journalists in the network actually work for commercial organisations, so or public broadcasting ones. So it's not that there's no money going to be made out of this story, but the real foundation of the work is in the public interest, not for profit, and I think that is important. And I think the aim, what they will be hoping, is that out of this come more resources so they then move on and deepen their links sort of internationally.
A WikiLeaks spokesperson has called for the Panama Papers data to be published in full online, but the head of the ICIJ said, "We don't want to dump documents on the internet, we want to do journalism. Our philosophy from day one has been to reclaim the journalism. We apply public interest tests to the documents." Jonathan, what's the merit in reporting the leaks in this way instead of dumping it all online?
I think this is a bit much better way to report it than the WikiLeaks style, which can be, which verges on irresponsible at times. And you see that in the hypocrisy even of Julian Assange's approach, where, he furiously guards his own privacy, but then is willing to sort of breach others. I mean, people are entitled to a degree of privacy, and in this case, I think it's a much more responsible way of handling it. Yes, we do have to trust journalists to manage and sift through the information, but that's what journalists are supposed to be able to do. And I think it ends up, the information is presented better, but it also avoids the risk, which you did have with WikiLeaks, where there were accusations that about the public interest involved, when it was just a sort of carte blanche leak, particularly with the diplomatic cables, where it was hard to tell in some cases what the public interest was, and when there was a risk of people and innocent people or diplomats having their careers or personal lives affected. So, I think I'd prefer this method.
a lot of all this information also will be published, and obviously there's a massive amount to go through and judgments to be made. I was actually a little bit surprised by WikiLeaks' statement, because I thought they'd sort of moved to a position when even they thought you need to go through documents before you publish them. But if you go on to the ICIJ site, you'll see that they've already got a huge database and they're going to add a lot of this material onto it in May. So that's only 6 weeks away. And you can actually search countries, you can search names and companies, and then you can even search addresses. And that can be significant, because if you're investigating a particular thing that's located in an address, it can be quite handy to sort of trawl through this database. So I don't think it's that they're saying they don't want to publish it, but they're actually just saying we need to make that judgment. And I think, I agree very much with, I agree with what Jonathan's saying. And I think also what Jared Ryle is trying to say, that this is journalism we're doing. But, you know, at the same time, I think that there was a lot of value in what WikiLeaks did. And at the same time, I also don't know that this would be happening if it wasn't for what WikiLeaks did in really breaking out with massive amount of data. So it's a little bit, that's maybe a little bit grey there.
Denham, what do you think, comparing the way WikiLeaks handled the leaks and the ICIJ did with the Panama Papers?
Yeah, I can completely agree with what Jonathan was saying. I think it's just a much more responsible and safer method to kind of deal with having this huge amount of data that nobody knows everything that's in the information. And if you just dump it online, you don't know what you're kind of putting up there or who you're exposing. So I think, I think with things like this, you have to trust the journalists, and it's kind of 400 journalists involved. It's not like you're placing that sort of trust on one person. And I think they are being quite transparent with the data they have. And I think they've said by, I think it's the start of May, they're going to post the full list of companies that are implicated in it. And then, I think it's a much kind of, it's a much more journalistic way to do it than kind of just dumping this information out there and letting other people go through it. It's kind of looking through it to find what is in the public interest. So, I think it's a much better method of doing it.
I'd just like to say, I don't want to completely move away from this idea that people can just publish data. For example, there's a thing called detention logs that put out there a whole lot of files which have enabled both researchers and journalists to do a lot of stories that they couldn't have otherwise done. So I do think I do think that the data people and the open source people have a big role to play in this sort of process as well.
You're listening to Fourth Estate. You're with me, Mariam Chihab, and I'm speaking to Wendy Bacon, Jonathan Perlman and Denham Sadler. The Panama Papers is the world's biggest data leak, 2.6 terabytes to be exact, with 11.5 million files for journalists to sift through. A couple of years ago, going through this information would have taken maybe years and years, and not as quickly as it was done. Denham, you wrote about how an Australian tech company that played an indispensable role in the Panama Papers investigation. Can you tell us more about this company and how exactly they helped the ICIJ sift through the data?
Yeah, sure. So it was this little kind of Sydney tech company called Nuix, and they've worked with the ICIJ before, and they kind of work with big data analytics. And basically what they did is, obviously the ICIJ had kind of, I think it was 11.5 million documents and this kind of PDFs and emails and photos. And Nuix has this software, this kind of smart algorithm that can index all of that and kind of make it searchable, to vastly oversimplify it. But they pretty much turned it into something where you could Google it. And what the journalists did was kind of, they had these lists of the politicians, the criminals and all these other people they wanted to look through in the documents. And then using this Sydney company's technology, they were then able to, pretty much like a Google search, they could search for anyone in those documents. I think the great quote from someone, the vice president from the company that I talked to, was saying it's kind of going from the really stereotypical kind of pin boards with the wires connecting all the relationships to kind of a quick search on the keyboard that takes a couple of seconds. So it was kind of, it was a nice little story of how this kind of Sydney tech company played their own kind of little role in this huge, huge data leak.
And so what do startup companies like this mean for investigative journalism in general, do you think?
Yeah, I think kind of just having that extra technology takes away the menial side of things. It takes away kind of just the manual labour of sifting through that many documents, which would just take an unimaginable amount of time if it's 11.5 million. And having that technology lets them actually get down to the actual hard part of it, the actual journalism part of things. But it kind of helps to make this sort of thing possible in this day and age, when obviously there's much fewer resources and it's it's coming from a not-for-profit agency that's kind of organising it all. Wendy, kind of helps facilitate it.
Oh, sorry, Wendy, what do you think?
I really agree with that. I really think there's a huge future in the collaboration between the open data people and people who can really program and write sophisticated searching tools such as maybe this was. I'm very ignorant about it, but I absolutely think that there's a big future in journalists collaborating with the open data people and bringing that together. Maybe into some new whole idea it'll be, but I think, yes. And I agree also that, yes, we can all search PDFs and all that sort of thing, but when you get the volume of this information and then being able to link all the relationships and things, it really, it does take programming skills. And while journalists can maybe get some basic scraping skills and basic programming skills and do data visualization, I think to really go beyond that, you probably at least you know, have to be a serious programmer.
And so do you think news organisations will rely more and more on this technology?
Oh, definitely. But I think, you know, they've got a certain amount in-house, like Fairfax would have. They do have, I know, data journalists. But to take it to that other level, and really we're talking here about masses and, you know, volumes of data. And look, I'm just incredibly impressed, I have to say, by the collaboration between our computer people too. Like, I know the journalism world better, but I have a little bit of insight into that world as well. And I just feel really optimistic about the fact there's young computer people in all around the world who actually collaborate with each other every day to keep things open source and build that culture as well. And I think it's good to talk about both sides of it, not that I'm qualified to talk about the data side.
Yeah. Jonathan, what do you think? Are you optimistic about this relationship between data people and journalists?
Yeah, I was just thinking about the ABS data, especially the census data. I mean, we're coming up to another census soon, I think. And the ABS are terrific at sort of analysing that data and putting it out to journalists. But there's now going scope for journalists and media companies to do that themselves and to break down the information in ways that they want. So I think it's going to open up whole new avenues for stories.
Well, that's it from us on Fourth Estate tonight. Thanks to my guests Wendy Bacon, Jonathan Perlman and Dennis Sadler. Don't forget, you can subscribe to Fourth Estate on iTunes or SoundCloud or your podcast player of choice. And of course, you can find us on Twitter and Facebook and at 2SER.com. My name's Mariam Chihab and you can catch us at the same time next week.